I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
It's a bit disconcerting to be reading an introduction to an interview about why words matter, how what we say reveals much about our inner thoughts and emotions, how language tells us and others how the mind works. Well, that's the subject of Steven Pinker's new book. It's called The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University, the author of several other books about language, the mind, and evolution. In this book, he writes about verbs, baby names, metaphors, swearing, jokes, politics, prepositional phrases. He calls humans verbivores, a species that lives on words. Well, what could be more important for an interview call-in program than a discussion about words and the relationship between language and thought? It's been a couple of years. Steven Pinker, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. So, does thought determine language? Language determine thought?
Well, I emphasize the way that language reflects thought rather than shaping it. That is, language wasn't designed by some committee and then imposed on people. It's a grassroots phenomenon that emerges out of people trying to express their thoughts and emotions. And if the language doesn't have a word or a phrase that's suited to saying what you want to say, you change the language. You invent a new construction, you borrow it from another language, you introduce a bit of slang or jargon, and that's how the language changes. That's how we end up with the language.
And you see this as part of natural selection, a reflection of natural selection, how languages evolve, how words evolve?
Well, there's a process of natural selection that gave us the circuitry to acquire language. And then the language itself over historical time evolves by a process that's in some ways like natural selection, but in some ways different because it can go on much faster. And there's a lot of kind of lateral transfer. That is, you don't just pass language on from parent to child, but also your friends, your buddies,
right.
Your colleagues, your
the
your
TV.
Mates.
Yeah. The TV
and radio. Yeah,
exactly.
That's right.
Exactly. Well, reading your book, I get the feeling that language is as much, it's about communication. It's about expressing ideas, emotions from one person to another, in this case. And it's also about relationships. I mean, it's those two things are sort of the primal part of what language is about.
That's right. And many of the puzzling aspects of language come from the fact that it has to do those two things at once. And that's why so often our words can't be taken at face value. If someone were to say over dinner table, if you could pass the salt, that would be awesome. If you think about it literally, that's kind of an overstatement.
It sure is.
And it's a little bit irrelevant pondering, you know, possible worlds over dinner. But the listener listens between the lines, knows that it must be a request for salt, because why else would the person be commenting on how good the state of affairs would be if he had it? But at the second level, the listener appreciates that the speaker is making an effort not to treat them as an underling or a flunky. Mm-hmm. Namely, instead of just saying, give me the salt, which presupposes that the listener will comply by slipping it in beneath the surface, the listener feels that he or she's been treated with respect.
So the difference between a question and a demand.
Well, it's actually a difference between a direct demand issued in so many words and a demand with some sugarcoating that makes it seem like it's not a demand. I mean, you can't go through life without asking for things.
Of course.
Really do want the salt, and it's at the other end of the table.
Right.
It's not so terrible to boss someone around in that sense, but you don't want to look like you're bossing them around. You don't want them to think that they're some kind of underling. And so to transact the business of everyday life, to get across the messages that you want to get across, without challenging the kind of relationships we maintain with one another, such as you and I are equals, you're not my servant, I produce a literal utterance that makes it sound like I'm just commenting on states of affairs, your mental spadework gets the command across.
But I could also understand in, let's say, an authoritarian family where pass the salt would be the verbal transaction. I mean, that's the way it would be around that table, and that would tell you something about the kind of family that you're dealing with, right?
Indeed. Direct commands like pass the salt, as opposed to all of this fluffy beating around the bush and innuendo and so on.
Would you mind? Yeah. I hate to bother you.
I wouldn't ask unless I really wanted it. There are really two things two kinds of relationships that are being negotiated there. One is a kind of vertical authority, boss, underling, and the other is a kind of stranger, intimate dimension. And so you can be direct either with your underlings or with people that you know so well that you no longer have to go through the motions. And anyone who learns a language like French or Spanish or German that has two forms of you, yeah, tu and vous,
yes,
learns to make these two distinctions. You use, for example, vous either for someone who is deserving of respect, who somehow higher than you,
formalized, I guess,
or a stranger, and so the social closeness and the hierarchical authority are the two dimensions you have to juggle.
Have you looked at how men and women speak differently, and have you noticed that there's some gender-based differences between how men and women use words?
I only briefly allude to that. I kind of hand that territory over to Deborah Tannen,
right,
in her bestseller "You Just Don't Understand," which is about that as a topic. But I do mention that when people say, "Well, men and women speak different languages," they don't mean they literally speak different languages. We use the same prepositions and nouns and so on, but where they differ is in this reading between the lines. And what Tannen does beautifully, and she kind of picks up from where I leave off, is how they differ in what linguists call implicatures, this interpretation of innuendo. And the miscommunication between men and women is often that no one disputes the literal meaning of what one member of a couple says, but what its function in the conversation, what you expect as a response, can at least statistically differ between men and women, according to Tannen.
And I don't want to go out on a limb here, but one thing I've noticed, and I mean, obviously I haven't done any research on this, but listening to members of Congress talk about the Iraq War, I tend to hear female members of Congress say things like, "Well, I think the war is bad," or "I think the war is good." I mean, in the most sort of crass description of the war. Whereas for men, you hear the war is bad, the war is good. That you hear the sort of "I think" as the beginning of the sentence for women. And again, you know, I haven't done any studies on this, but I've noticed that.
Yes, well, there is a feminine style of speech, which isn't the same, of course, as a woman's style of speech. Not all women speak with the feminine style. And a linguist named Robin Lakoff, who is Deborah Tannen's graduate advisor, wrote a book many years ago, 35 years ago, called Language and Women's Place, which basically documented that feminine speech is loaded with these politeness marker reflexes, questioning instead of asserting, hedging, the uptalk style, which now is almost universal among Americans under 30, began more as a feminine than a masculine speech style.
Well, you end the sentence up. Right.
Yes, I'm Steve. I'm talking to you on a program. I've written a book, that kind of thing.
Well, let me talk about some other words. And I have to say, reading your book got me thinking a lot about words and how words have been used to describe the war in Iraq. Whether it's an invasion, whether it's an occupation, whether it's a liberation, whether it's even a war itself.
That's right. Words are used to frame a situation. And one of the features of the mind that I emphasize right from the beginning of the book is how the mind has the ability to frame a particular situation in multiple ways. And I came upon this just from minute technical analyses of what verbs mean. Even something as simple as putting water in a glass can be construed in two different ways, as doing something to the water, namely causing it to move, or doing something to the glass, namely causing it to become full. And that's why we have different verbs, to pour and to fill, and you can't use them in the same way.
No.
You say, "I poured water into the glass," not "I poured the glass with water." "I filled the glass with water," not "I filled water into the glass." Now that's what led me to this whole area is if in something as simple as a verb, there are two completely different ways of looking at the same silly little situation, for something much larger like the abortion debate or the stem cell debate or healthcare or Iraq, think of the number of different ways that people can look at the same situation and think about it differently. I think we can use language to encourage other people to frame an event the way we are currently framing it, though I think that the difference goes deeper than language itself. I think the language reflects the mind's ability to construe reality in different ways.
Well, I mean, and I don't want to get totally stuck on this, but if someone calls Iraq an occupation or a liberation, I mean, it seems to me that tells you a lot about the speaker. I mean, it tells you a lot about their politics, doesn't it?
That's right. Although I also emphasize, I don't want to be interpreted as saying that we just live in a world of words, that it just depends on how you describe something, that there isn't any reality. I think you can evaluate the truth of statements like Iraq was an invasion or a liberation, and it all depends on whether the Iraqis themselves welcomed the troops or not. So one can go on the ground and evaluate these. There really is a fact of the matter behind it. We use language to project one theory or another as to what's going on, but we can also test those theories.
Sure. Speaking of verbs, and you have a description of verbs in this book, which I liked a lot, the chassis of the sentence.
Yes.
I like that.
The verb.
I could use that maybe in grammar.
That is, it's a framework with slots that the subject and the object and the various complements and prepositional phrases have to get snapped into slots that the verb defines. So the verb is the chassis or the framework of a sentence.
And then you build all the words.
You build the rest of the sentence around it. Yeah.
Well, and also hearing you talk and also going through the book as well, you have to really then marvel at how children learn language.
It is marvelous,
because you can make it sound so complicated that we don't even know, you know, what we're saying or why we're saying what we're saying. But this is what kids have to figure out as infants, and then
indeed, and then in fact, that's what led me to the whole problem is trying to figure out that aspect of the problem of learning a language in childhood.
And I mean, kids learn; they're listening, they're doing, they're observing.
They are observing. Language acquisition can't just be a kind of cryptography where you listen to a bunch of syllables and you notice which one occurs before which other one, like, you know, what the CIA might do to Russian verbiage. They're, at the same time as they're hearing words come out of their parents' and siblings' mouths, they're looking around. They're also doing a little bit of intuitive psychology, trying to figure out what mom and dad are talking about when all those sounds come out of their mouths. And I think it's the process of fitting the meaning of the sentence, which they guess from the context and from their knowledge of the world, from their psyching out their parents, with the actual stream of sound that drives acquiring a language.
And that's why we learn that parents who talk a lot to their children or live in a world where there's language, acquire language so much faster and have a more sophisticated use of language, even at a young age.
It's possible, although, as I emphasized in the blank slate, we also have to worry about the fact that articulate parents might have articulate children because they pass on genes for articulateness.
Right.
So until you are sure that happens, say, with adoptive parents and their children, we don't really know that it's a direct effect of the input. We also have reason to believe that kids acquire language much more attentively from their peers than from their parents. And the most obvious sign of that is an accent. When a parent emigrates from one country, or even from one part of a country to another, from Brooklyn to Alabama or vice versa, kids always end up with the accent of their peers, not of their parents. And, of course, children of immigrants who never master the language of the adopted country, if they're exposed to kids peers who speak English, they'll end up just fine. You can't tell them apart from the children of native-born Americans.
That's fascinating. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And Steven Pinker is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a psychologist. He's written a number of books, and he's got a new one just out. It's called The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Rowan University supports WHYY. Located in southern New Jersey, Rowan provides students the resources of a large university with the small class size of a college. Rowan offers 42 undergraduate majors, 38 master's degrees, and a doctorate in education leadership. Online and accelerated degree programs and professional development are also available through their new College of Professional and Continuing Education. Details at rowan.edu/info.
Take a closer look at Africa's problems.
The greatest shortage today is not of resolve, but of resources.
Its politics.
Some of us think that Africa's unity has become a matter of survival.
And its people.
Omar Simpson, I'd seen it once in television.
I'm Farai Chidea. Join us for our next Africa Update, Tuesdays on News and Notes from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. The publication of Alan Greenspan's new memoir coincides with questions being raised about his role in the creation of the subprime mortgage meltdown. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the former chair of the Federal Reserve about that crisis, the Bush tax cuts, the war in Iraq, and more. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Steven Pinker is our guest. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University. He's also taught at Stanford and MIT. He's written several books, including The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, and The Blank Slate, which was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize. He serves on the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary, and you can read his writings, his essays in magazines like Time and The New York Times and The New Republic, and he's got a new book out, which we're talking about. It's called The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, let's talk about swearing on the radio. And of course, the FCC doesn't allow us to illustrate anything, which I always thought was an interesting phenomenon, but nonetheless, it's the world that we live in. How do you see swearing? And you talk about almost five kinds of swearing.
Yes, the common denominator of swearing is evoking negative emotion in the mind of your listener. And anyone who speaks more than one language knows that you can't translate the swear words from one language into another and hope to be understood. Where I grew up in Quebec, in Quebecois French, what you say when you stub your toe or when someone steals your parking space is goddamn tabernacle or goddamn chalice. The religious, the swearing is religious.
Yes.
As it is in, or at least it was in English, in words like damn and hell, which used to be bad words, as when Rhett Butler shocked audiences by saying, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. And that was scandalous in 1939. Right. Now it's pretty mild stuff. There's also sexual swearing, taboo language about excretion, taboo language about disfavored groups. Indeed, the most offensive word in contemporary American English is not the F word, but the N word, referring to the racial minority.
Right.
And of course, and words on, about disease, death, infirmity, more so in other languages than in English. So there's a common denominator of negative emotion, of hatred, of disgust, of revulsion, of depravity, fear of gods, and so on. And there are a number of reasons why you might want to evoke a negative thought in the head of your listener. Using language as a kind of weapon, as a way of infiltrating their brain and causing them to think a thought that they may not want to be thinking. You might want to humiliate or denigrate them, as when you advise people to engage in undignified sexual acts when they've crossed you. You might want to emphasize the disagreeable aspect of a phenomenon. If someone is letting their dog foul your lawn and you open the window and you yell something at them and the time for politeness is past, you may want to choose a word that reminds them that this is disagreeable stuff. So, in the mildest form, only the ability of the word to arouse emotion is used, and it's used just to arouse the listener's attention or to assert a kind of macho pose, and you get what's sometimes called the F patois, where every word is emphasized, every other word is emphasized with the F word.
But I wonder, since there is so much more swearing, it seems, in public, obviously not on the radio, but in public, than there used to be, whether you like it or not, whether those words still then can evoke that negative emotion, whether it even can hurt someone the way it did in the past, when it was really reserved for those very special moments. And now, frankly, you hear it everywhere.
Yeah, it's
also shocking, at least.
It's the best reason for discouraging people from swearing too much is it robs the words of their power for those occasions which you really do want to use them. You want to keep the powder dry. Mm. I think they still, even though they are used more than they used to, people are still a little touchy about them. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just on the radio, even in audiences when I give a lecture, and I never swear. I talk about swearing, which I insist
you're very
is something
careful
very
about
different.
That. I was quite impressed.
I name the words when I lecture on audiences or on C-SPAN, where on cable you're allowed to do that. But still, I can see audiences pinging every time one of those words is used.
And you think that's context, though? I mean, here you've got a Harvard professor
it could be
using
in a formal setting. And indeed, the use of taboo words is specific to the speaker, which is why African Americans can address each other affectionately with the N-word, but not a white person, as Michael Kramer. That actor who plays Kramer on Seinfeld learned to his misfortune at that comedy club.
Where he went berserk and was using the word and got in hot water for that. Although, interestingly, the NAACP meeting over the summer decided to bury the N-word. I mean, as someone that looks at language, is that effective, do you think? I mean, is that a good thing to do with a word, even a word that has such negative history and meaning?
It's generally almost impossible to legislate language. The FCC can keep it off the broadcast airwaves, but broadcast airwaves are kind of a tiny little island in a sea of cable, internet, satellite, and so on, where it's unregulated. And interesting, even in broadcast media, throughout the 20th century, there's been one infraction after another. And it's kind of ironic that, and I note this in the book, that it's really a sign of our great political and moral progress, that the major free speech battles in the U.S. and the U.K. have not come from political challenges, from people speaking truth to power. I can say that, you know, that George Bush is a liar and a moron, and I won't get put in jail. But if I use certain words for excretion and copulation, then your station will get fined. And all of the major court cases about Henry Miller and Lady Chatterley's Lover and George Carlin have been over words for excretion and sex, not over challenges to political authority. So in one sense, it's something to celebrate.
Right.
And it used to be you'd have your tongue cut out, or worse, if you criticize the leadership. Now you can do it. But it still is puzzling that you can get in trouble for using these particular words.
But do you see it as hypocrisy, or is it just that there's something about these words have been, you know, put in a special category and are treated in a different kind of way?
They are treated in a different kind of way, and even as certain words become more common, like the F word, which used to be you couldn't say it in mixed company, that is around women. You used to call it locker room language, things that men would only say amongst themselves. But it's not as if linguistic taboos have disappeared, and some words have become more offensive, even as others have become less offensive.
So
the N word would be a perfect example.
Sure.
Many children would say a rhyme, which we now euphemize as "eeny meeny miny mo catch a tiger by the toe," but it wasn't originally tiger. And I remember saying it as a kid. It wasn't. We knew it wasn't quite polite, but now it would be lethal to say that.
Sure.
So you always have some sort of linguistic taboos, whether they're about religion, sex, or race, can change with a decade.
And I'm assuming this is true in other languages as well. I mean, we're talking about the English language here, but other languages also have these kinds of taboos around those words.
That's right. Often not necessarily about sex. Right. It could be about gods. It could be about dangers. Cultures that do a lot of hunting of dangerous animals, often the name of the leopard or the jaguar will be taboo. Actors, for some reason, cannot mention Macbeth. The play, euphemism
that's
for that. But emotionally fraught situations often breed taboo words. I mean, in the case of these broadcast restrictions, I don't think it's unreasonable that parents who don't want to have to explain to their children what all these sexual terms are have channels that they can turn on that don't use them casually. And, you know, in a marketplace, there ought to be a niche for that. On the other hand, to prevent, say, Ken Burns in his documentary on World War II from interviewing soldiers and listening to how soldiers talk, I mean, that's the way soldiers talk, means that you're cutting yourself off from contact with the way other people live and speak. And I think that is a deplorable kind of hypocrisy.
Let me just do one follow-up, and then we'll get to our callers here, because you talk about, in terms of swear words, including references to disease and infirmity. And I wonder, as, you know, we rid the world of more diseases and there are more cures for more infirmities, whether those kinds of words are going away. You know what I mean?
You often read in an obituary that so-and-so passed away from a long illness, which is
whatever that long is illness.
Well, it's cancer.
Yes,
but the word cancer is on borderline taboo status because it is still a dreaded malady. It still gives us a shiver when we see it, and we feel a little bit better seeing a long illness. In earlier times, when there were more diseases, you had overt swearing with names of diseases. In Yiddish, you can say cholera as a curse, cholera, right. In an age in which cholera was as much of a threat to them as cancer is to us today.
And that's Steven Pinker, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about words and language today on the show, and he's got a new book. It's called The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's get some callers in on the conversation, including Maria from Stockton, New Jersey. Maria, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I have a question about language death or extinction or evolution. I've seen several articles lately about languages in smaller countries such as Papua New Guinea and small countries in South America like Peru and Ecuador, in which the languages have either gone extinct or joined with the dominant language in that country. I was just wondering if you, Professor, had any thoughts on that, if you could speak to that.
Sure.
What you believe is lost when a language goes extinct. Is this good, bad, natural?
Yes.
Maria, thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead.
You know, it's a terrific question. And it's not just these small countries. It's also the United States, mm-hmm. where Native American languages are dropping like flies. And there are many languages where you go to the community and you see that the only people who speak it are in their 80s. And, you know, you can sort of figure out what's going to happen. It is a tragedy because each language embodies the collective experience of a people. It has its own poetry, not only the poetry written in that language, but the poetry of the language. It's a source of historical information. Very often, the only way to trace the history of a people is to look at how similar their language is to neighboring languages. The way that we know that the Gypsies, now called the Roma or the Romani, originated in India is that their language is from the Indo-Iranian family. All that is lost when a language is lost, in the same way that when a species goes extinct, we lose a trove of information and a source of beauty and diversity in the natural world. Clearly we can't save them all. Just as I don't speak the language of my grandparents, because I want to be part of a larger country,
sure.
We can't put a gun to people's heads and say, speak Lakota, because we want to keep the Lakota language alive. What I think we can do is at least try to document as many languages as possible before they go extinct. And I'm associated with a foundation, the Endangered Language Fund, mm-hmm. that tries to document languages and to prevent real abuses where there are communities who do want to keep their language, and because of a mandatory schooling in monolingually in the dominant language, the language is being pushed out. That kind of coerced language death ought to be prevented.
Do you see this as part of globalization, or is it part of the sort of, you know, that extinction is also part of natural selection, that while some languages might be erased or dying off with the elders, other words are being created in other parts of the world?
Yeah, certainly there is a, I think it's mainly a process of globalization,
mm-hmm.
and before that, of nationalization, of the fact that nations such as the United States become homogeneous, yeah. from coast to coast. I don't think there's a Darwinian competition between languages. I don't think that English is so widespread because there's something that was better about English in the first place, simply because languages adapt to the needs of their speakers. Hebrew, which was formerly a language of only of prayer and biblical and Talmudic scholarship, all of a sudden became the language of a technological nation state when it was revived in Palestine and then Israel. The language didn't handicap people because when they needed new terms, they invented them.
That's
what happens with languages. But it certainly is a source of, and it is also true, of course, that there's no such thing as English. There are Englishes, Singapore, India, and so on. But still, the amount of diversity, mm-hmm. is far less than when you have 6,000 languages compared to, say, if we ended up with 600, which is a distinct possibility.
So what do you make of the English-only campaign in the U.S.?
Well, I don't think the government should be regulating the language that people use in private conversation or even in public spaces. I don't think it's a terrible idea to have some national language and to encourage immigrants to acquire it just for the sake of reducing, mm-hmm. conflict within the nation's borders.
So people understand each other, you're saying?
People understand each other so that there is some approximation of a common culture and therefore the kind of social and political capital that makes a country harmonious.
Let me get back to our callers. Maria, thanks for the call. We've got Gary from Mount Holly joining us. Hi, Gary. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
A pleasure to be talking to you. Dr. Pinker, I was curious about two things. The first is, what scientific or other data do you base your conclusions on? And the second is, what, if anything, do you say about speech acts?
Well, the book has lots and lots of topics, everything from swearing to the grammar of verbs to spread of baby names to language in the brain. And depending on the state of the art in all of these different subfields, the kind of evidence brought to bear varies. In some cases, it's just judgments by native speakers as to what sounds weird and what sounds natural. In some cases, it's analyses from brain imaging or what patients lose when a part of the brain is damaged. In some cases, it's the errors that children make in their spontaneous speech. In other cases, college students come into the lab for some beer money and respond to words being flashed on a screen. And in some cases, it's statistical databases of large samples of English text that can be analyzed by computer.
You, speaking of names, you have a section here about names, including your own, the fact that there are a number of, I guess, scientists with the first name of Stephen, but you also talk about how names will tell you something about a certain time and place. For instance, Edna Ethel Bertha, a senior citizen, Susan Nancy Deborah, an aging baby boomer, Jennifer Amanda Heather, a 30-something, and Isabella Madison and Olivia are children.
Yes.
Reflecting, I guess, the time that people live in, right?
That's right. Although, interestingly, it's very hard to see what they reflect about that time. There are, anytime you try to test a hypothesis about why a particular name is popular in a given decade, it always fails. This is work done by my colleague Stanley Lieberson at Harvard. But it's not true, for example, that biblical names are more popular in times of religious revival. Huh. Quite the contrary. The great fad of, you know, Adam and Joshua and so on came as belief was decreasing. It's not true that feminism has made any particular change. It's not that, say, girls' names that are diminutive of boys, mm-hmm. like Roberta or Michaela, have gone out. There are changes, but they seem to be internally driven. They really fashion in the sense that you react to the names that are already out there. You want to give your kid a name that's distinctive but not too distinctive. You listen for the names that are in circulation, mm-hmm. the ones that seem stale, that seem fresh, that seem geriatric, that seem hip, and there's an internal dynamic that just can't be tied to any socioeconomic factor.
It's interesting. And again, we're almost up on a break here because you do hear of people who just entirely make up brand new names that have, you know, never, as far as I know, existed before.
And that itself is a new trend in baby naming. There have been earlier trends like, for, you know, Celtic names, biblical names, girls' names from boys' names, and so on. And there is a trend, especially in the African-American community, of inventing euphonious new sounds, often with a vague African or French feel, Lakeisha, Shamiqua, Shaquille, Latrell, and so on.
Oh, I'll tell you what, we will take that short break and then get back to our guest, Stephen Pinker. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University, and he's written a number of books, including The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, and The Blank Slate. And we're talking about his new book. It's called The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. And he is also on the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary, joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and we'll take some more calls here on Radio Times. Gary, thanks for the call. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Cardiovascular Center at the Chester County Hospital supports WHYY. Just as we're a partner in cardiac surgery with Cleveland Clinic, we want our patients to be partners in care with us. To help you get the facts you need, our website now features important information about quality of care, patient satisfaction, and more. Located in Westchester, Pennsylvania, and online at 866drheart.com, the Cardiovascular Center is part of the health network of the Chester County Hospital. Beyond good care.
Next time on Day to Day, writer Calvin Trillant raised his family in New York City, but he still sees the world from the Midwest.
When I tried to think of what I'd want the theme of my daughter's childhoods to be, I thought of, despite all evidence to the contrary, you're being raised in Kansas City.
I'm going to Kansas City.
Pack your bags. We're heading to Kansas City, Missouri.
It's the center of the world, of course.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Former Fed Reserve Chair Alan Greenspan is blaming Republicans for runaway government spending, while the critic is blaming Greenspan for problems with the economy. Also, for something completely different, a conversation with Michael Palin. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Today on the show, what do words say about us? And Steven Pinker is our guest. And again, we've got calls coming in to 1-888-477-9499. You had mentioned the word metaphor before, and you write quite a bit about metaphor in this book, saying that the mind works metaphorically. And I found that really, first of all, beautiful and provocative, and I'm interested in having you explain how that works.
Metaphor is not just a literary ornament, but it's almost difficult to find a passage of ordinary speech that isn't metaphorical. We talk about our spirits rising and falling as if they were a balloon, or forcing ourselves to be nice as if there was one little person in our head manhandling the other. Or we say to a romantic partner, look how far we've come, as if love is a journey. And the linguist George Lakoff has assembled literally hundreds, maybe thousands, of these metaphors in everyday speech that we don't even realize are metaphors. And the psychological question is, do we really have little images of, you know, people shoving each other around,
exactly,
or things moving around on a stage as we talk? Is the mind metaphorical in the sense that we just can't think abstractly? Or the other extreme is that these are just figures of speech, that when the first wordsmith in the dawn of time had to come up with a word for coercing yourself to do something, they could have used, you know, glorg or spilk, but instead they chose a word that was similar enough to something that people were familiar with. They'd make a good guess at what the person was talking about, but then as it proliferated through the community, they became opaque and people simply used them as sounds, which is why you get dead metaphors like the Philadelphia Eagles' Achilles heel is rearing its ugly head, or the ship of state is sailing down
apparently
a one-way
last night, yes.
The ship of state is sailing down a one-way street.
Yes.
Or figurative uses of literally. I mean, it often drives people crazy the way some people will use literally, not meaning literally. My favorite example I have in the book is when one of Richard Nixon's defenders during Watergate said the American press has literally emasculated the president. So those
they tried, but they not so literally successful that way.
So those errors show that you can't take the presence of concrete metaphorical language in our everyday conversation too literally. That people may not actually see through to the referent. So the truth is probably somewhere in between. Yeah. A lot of our language, our abstract ideas are rooted in concrete experiences, but we also have the ability to think abstractly when we need to.
Well, as I was reading about this, I was thinking of Temple Grandin, who's a very well-known woman with autism and also an extraordinary human being, and she's been doing fascinating research. She was on the show, and I was asking her how she thinks, and she thinks in pictures. So when someone says the word freedom or liberty, she describes seeing the Statue of Liberty, and then she was able to sort of, you know, piece together her conversation based on the series of pictures that she could create. First of all, I found that absolutely fascinating, but as you were talking about metaphors and whether we speak and think literally or whether we speak in pictures or metaphorically, I just wanted to throw that out, just get your response to that, because, I mean, she's a unique individual, but I think an interesting perspective on language.
Yes, and I think we all do that to some extent.
I was thinking about that.
I mean, we must in the way that we constantly spin out new variations around a metaphorical theme, and this is one of Lakoff's arguments. So we don't just say that, look how far we've come in a relationship. We say, well, it's been a long, bumpy road,
yes,
or she's thinking of bailing out, or our relationship is on the rocks. And we can even understand new ones, like, oh, I think you and I should step on the brakes. Mm. Now, that's not a cliche. I've used it for the first time, but you wouldn't be able to understand it unless you could think of the underlying abstract core metaphor of love being a kind of journey. So there is evidence that we organize abstract concepts like a relationship around concrete metaphors, and the language is one of the best kinds of evidence for that.
And I guess a cliche is just an overused metaphor?
That's right. And a cliche comes to, you get mixed metaphors and misuses of literally when a metaphor dies and people no longer think through to the underlying image.
Let me get Jack from Allentown to join us. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Hi, how are you? I'm really enjoying the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm an immigrant who came to the U.S. when I was 9 years old, and I'm the only one in the family who never had an accent. I guess that's testifying to what the doctor said earlier about the effect of your peers.
Yes.
Instead of the effect of your family. But my question centers around the multilingual folks. Do the rules of language, the complexity of having a multilingual nature to you, do the rules still apply, for example, swearing? What if the immigrant is swearing just to fit in and not for any other reason?
Yes.
Are we reading too much into it?
Thank you, Jack, for the call.
No, that's an insightful observation.
Yeah.
And many multilingual people feel, they learn how to swear in the second language, but they feel it's not quite as piquant, that it's just not as, they don't get the same zing from it.
Yes.
It's not as satisfying or as arousing as swearing in their first language. And what that suggests is, just as there seems to be a sensitive period for acquiring an accent, there may be a sensitive period for acquiring the emotional coloring of words, in particular taboo words, that you might have to actually witness someone screaming his head off while blurting out these words, or to get the reaction, if you use it yourself, of disapproval around people, for it to really be stamped in with that emotion.
Jack, thanks for the call. Let's get Frank from Reading to join us. Hi, Frank. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I had a question. He was talking about swear words earlier, and I had a question regarding the N-word. I had actually lived with a black person during my undergraduate years, and we were pretty close friends, and he would often refer to me using that word. And now I find myself in a language diversity graduate course, and I'm writing a memoir about the experience and about the language we would use. And I find myself trying to censor before I even get it written.
Right.
So I'm wondering, should I not use that word in my writing? I'm hesitant to use it when I speak, but if I'm trying to recount something accurately,
right,
where does that put me, and what sort of awkward situations? And the other part of that question was, do you think like he would use it as a source of empowerment, or taking the sort of taboo out of the word by using it affectionately?
Yeah, and yes. I mean, many questions.
Very much, yes.
Yeah. Sorry.
Frank,
my teacher couldn't answer them. I was hoping he could.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, a lot of taboo words are appropriated by their targets, such as the N-word as a term of affection and solidarity. You have lesbian groups like, you know, Dykes on Bikes. You've got Queer Nation. You have feminist groups that call themselves bitches and so on. As a deliberate attempt to say, well, if I can use the word referring to myself, how much of a sting can it really have? On the other hand, you do have to be careful how you use it. And there's a wonderful scene in the movie Rush Hour where an African-American detective played by Chris Tucker is shadowed by a Hong Kong detective played by Jackie Chan, who speaks no English. They go into this really tough bar, and Chris Tucker says, "What's up, my using the N-word?"
Yeah.
And Jackie Chan innocently follows his lead, and a riot breaks out.
Not surprising.
So a riot can break out if it's used in the wrong context by the wrong person, no matter how sanitized we try to make it.
But there are not rules about this, are there? I mean, you just have to sort of pick your way through the various potential reactions if you use a loaded word like this.
I suspect that there are rules that are fairly subtle, and that people assimilate unconsciously, just instinctively.
Frank, thanks for the call, and good luck with that paper. I don't know if you got a better answer from our guest than you did your professor. Let me shift gears here, because you include in this book, under a title, Words and Reality, the 16 words that made it into President Bush's State of the Union address. And these are the 16 words that have haunted him, I think, in his administration since that time. The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Out of that sentence, you pick the word learned. That's really the key word in this sentence. Why so?
The question is, was he, we know that he was mistaken, was he deceptive.
Yes.
Now, the word learn is has a theory of reality in it. You can only use it of true things. It's what's called a factive verb. So I can't learn. So I can't learn that Dewey defeated Truman because Dewey didn't defeat Truman. Truman defeated Dewey. I can think it. I can
yes.
believe it.
Yes.
But I can't learn it. That's why Mark Twain could say, it used to be that I could remember both the things that happened and the things that didn't. Now I can only remember the things that never happened. Now that's funny. Why is
yes,
that
it
funny?
Is. It's very funny.
It's because the word remember is like the word learn and the word know. You can only use it if something is true. If mm-hmm. you yourself believe it to be true. If you say it and you don't have grounds for believing that it's true, then you're using it deceptively. Mm-hmm. And I think the case could be made for learn in those infamous 16 words.
And just shifting to another president and another set of words, and this goes to President Clinton, when he was being asked questions about Monica Lewinsky and did they have sex or not, and he made that famous is argument. I'll just read what he says. And he's asked whether or not your attorney knew of your relationship with Ms. Lewinsky. The statement that there was no sex of any kind in any manner, shape, or form with President Clinton was an utterly false statement. Is that correct? And Clinton says, it depends on what the meaning of the word is. If is means is and never has been, that's one thing. If it means there is none, that is a completely true statement.
Yes.
Yikes.
It got him impeached.
It got him impeached.
It was one of the five counts against him.
Exactly. Now, you're saying, linguistically speaking...
I think he's absolutely right. That is, whether a statement is true or not depends on the verb tense. At the time that he made that statement, his affair with Monica Lewinsky was over. And so if he's asked about, is there sex of any kind, and he said no, mm-hmm. he is correct. He wasn't asked, was there sex of any kind? Now, admittedly, there is some fuzziness there.
Yes, sir.
When is an affair really over? I mean, when it's not as if you're incapable of renewing it any time. It's like how much time has to elapse after a smoker has had the last cigarette to say, I've quit. You know, I used to smoke, given that he could pick it up at any time. But still, it was a number of months. I think he was justified on semantic grounds. But in terms of usage, what linguists call pragmatics, that is, what your listener expects, I think the legal issue really hinges on whether this was satisfies the requirement to tell the whole truth. Because what the prosecutor was getting at was, have you ever, was
of
there
course,
any sex?
Of course.
Now, and Clinton, fully aware of that, said, I was trying to be truthful but not particularly helpful, which is exactly right. And the question is, if you're committed to the whole truth, is it good enough to be truthful but not helpful? The Senate, of course, had one opinion. The House had another opinion on that very issue.
Let me get Chris from West Philadelphia to join us. Chris, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, how's it going? I was wondering if your guest was familiar with the essay by George Orwell, Politics in the English Language. And
yes.
I just thought it was interesting the way that author kind of makes generalizations about different spectrums of the political realm and how they express themselves.
Mm. Okay, Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Anything you want to add?
Yes, it's a marvelous essay published, mm-hmm. I believe, in the late 40s, and it first raised people's awareness of the way that language can frame situations and therefore be used to deceive. So terms like collateral damage or a transfer of populations, which hide a lot of the grisly details right. under an abstraction, can be propaganda tools of a deceptive government. And Orwell masterfully pointed out some of those techniques.
Let me raise something else, and this is more a pet peeve of mine than anything else. The statement, mistakes were made.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The elusive passive.
This is called the elusive passive versus
yes.
Or
the evasive passive,
we
yes.
We made a mistake, or we made
that's
mistakes.
Right.
I mean, you hear this all the time now, especially when people are being hauled before some congressional committee. Mistakes were made.
That's right. It's been attributed to Ronald Reagan during the Iran-Contra and Henry Kissinger and others. I mean, it's what the passive voice is good at doing, namely hiding the agent, the cause of something. Mistakes were made leaves it open that
yes.
they weren't made by me, but by someone else.
But it sounds absurd, though, doesn't it? I mean, if you think about it, it really sounds absurd, doesn't it? I mean, mistakes don't make themselves, do they?
That's right. Well, there's actually, it's interesting. Language allows a continuum of ways of describing the cause of some event. So, for example, if you say the ship sank or the bus blew up, it implies that there wasn't any identifiable cause, maybe, you know, lack of preventive maintenance, and, you know, it just happened. If you say the ship was sunk or the bus was blown up, it says that there was an agent, but leaves it unstated who it was. If you say terrorists blew up the bus, then, you know, or Palestinian terrorists, you're actually identifying who they were. So there's a continuum. And mistakes were made doesn't deny that someone made them, but it does hide who made them, in particular the speaker.
I was saying, especially the person.
Yes, it leaves it open that it was not the speaker's fault. That's right, exactly.
And hopefully we can see through those kinds of statements. I also am struck by when you read a transcript of a verbatim conversation, like if there were a transcript of our conversation, it probably would look like gobbledygook.
Oh, yes.
Because the way we speak and the way we write are so different.
Indeed,
and yet
they
we understand each other.
We do.
Allegedly.
And, I mean, when you see a court transcript, or say the Watergate transcripts back in the 70s, I mean, they sounded just like, you know, blithering, you know, gibbering incompetence, mm-hmm. Which in one sense I suppose they were, but not because of their language. Because I know this because often I'll be invited to give a talk, and they'll say, well, we also want you to write a paper. And I say, I'm sorry, I don't have time to write a paper. Right. They said, no problem, we'll record your talk, send you the transcript, you just clean up the punctuation, and you get an essay for free. And then I look at what I say, and I can't believe what an incoherent fool I am when I see my words in print. It's partly because the ear forgives errors that span over long stretches of words. So if the end of the sentence doesn't quite match up in agreement with the beginning, you can get away with it when your listener's short-term memory can't keep track of it. But sitting there on the page, right, you can scan back and forth and you see every little flaw. But it's also because of this process we discussed earlier in the session about how listeners have to fill in between the lines. You don't actually say everything that you mean. Conversation would bog down, and you count on the cooperation of your listener. Something that's much easier to do if your listener is there in the room with you, following your eye contact and your nods and vice versa, than if it's a generic audience whose background you don't know, who's coming across your words on the printed page.
Well, much more to talk about, and I thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And our guest has been Steven Pinker, and his new book is called The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. Appreciate your phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Find out more about the program, including podcasts and years of archive programs there as well. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, and Susan Greenbaum are the producers of Radio Times. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and you're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.